Now we were speaking yesterday about the religious situation in Europe when the Reformation began. And we noticed first that true Christianity was then found to a very limited extent in every part of Europe. As I said, please try to get here on time after this. I don't like people coming in late to class at all. But then second, we noticed that during the Middle Ages, there were superstitious accretions to Christianity which greatly developed and in many places seemed almost to have completely displaced biblical Christianity. We notice the difference between religion and magic, and nowhere is this brought out more clearly than in the very common practice in the Middle Ages of making vows, that if God will do such a thing for me, then I will give some candles to a certain church, or I will make a gift to a certain organization or something. Making a bargain with God that you will do something with God if he will do something for you. That is magic. That is not Christianity. And that had come to be very common in the Middle Ages. Then there was the worship of saints, and that, of course, has not yet entirely disappeared. Some years ago, I purchased a Catholic almanac downtown here in Philadelphia, and I found toward the end of it there was a page on which it told which saints to pray for just about any disease or trouble you can think of. If you had lost your purse, you prayed to a certain saint. If you had toothache, you prayed to a different saint. It gave about 50 saints. This particular one to pray for each particular thing. Now, of course, there's nothing like that in the scripture anywhere. And it simply illustrates the common tendency of mankind to work things out in his own head instead of looking to the scripture to see what he should believe about religious things. But it's the sort of thing that can easily develop, and there is no church probably in the world today in which a certain number of accretions and additions to what the scripture teaches have not come in, either come in previously and been taken over, or have come in more recent years. It's a thing we all have to watch again. But in the course of 1,000 years of the Middle Ages, this had developed to a very great extent. And closely related with it is Mariolatry. There is a statement made in the early days of the Reformation by a certain priest that people would be much wiser to pray to Mary than to Christ, because they said Jesus is the righteous judge whose wrath we fear, and Mary is the benevolent, loving one who will be kind to us. And they said if we pray to her, she has far greater influence with her son than we can have. So it is much wiser, it said, to pray to Mary than to pray to Christ. A few years ago, I was up in Quebec, and there we visited the Church of St. Anne de Pré. And there, in that Church of St. Anne de Pré, there was a statement someone put up. He said that if you want Jesus to do something, the best thing to do is to pray to his mother, because she has far more influence with him than you can have. But he said, who will have the greatest influence with the Virgin Mary? Naturally, her mother. So he said, I pray to St. Anne rather than to Mary. And here was this great, tremendous church, these things, and they both pray. Well, of course, all this is an accretion on the scripture. The scripture teaches that Jesus is the righteous judge, but it also teaches that he is the only atonement, the only source of redemption, the only mediator between God and man. And while Mary was a very wonderful woman, whom the Lord gave the great privilege of being the mother of our Lord in his earthly capacity, yet she was only a human being, and she needed redemption the same as any of us. But these accretions had gradually developed in the Middle Ages, and you would find that there were many whose religion consisted of various faiths of this, while along with them there were individuals who were truly looking to Christ for salvation and who were born again through his precious love. And so you had a mixed-up situation in which the true gospel was found as it is found today in most of our great denominations, but it was pretty much overshadowed by superstitions and other things, as I fear it is today in most of our great denominations, so that it's apt to be the ignorant or the people who take a few words at face value rather than to take the whole teaching of the church who receive the gospel and are truly saved by Christ. That was the situation at the beginning of the Reformation as far as religion was concerned. But now we want to look at C, the ecclesiastical situation in Europe. Capital C, the ecclesiastical situation in Europe. This does not immediately impress us in America so much as a separate and important subject as it would in some other countries, because in this country we have the idea of separation of church and state, and the denominations are quite distinct from governmental control. But in many other countries today, the church is a state church and is at least nominally under control of the state, and in turn for its very existence has to try to have some measure of control over the state. That is a process that works both ways. When you get anything that is controlled by something else in its own, for its own preservation, it has to try to control the thing that controls it. That is one of the great forces in the modernist gaining control of many of our great denominations, is a system which grew up within the last 100 years, it was quite unknown before, in which denominations, as denominations, ran missionary enterprises. And consequently, you had boards and agencies which were controlled by the denomination. And the result was that in these great denominations, they would have a meeting once a year with representatives from all over the country, and these representatives, with many things to discuss in a few days together, would make the decisions that determine the future of their schools, of their mission agencies, of all their boards and agencies. And men whose lives were devoted to these schools or these agencies, having to work all year planning how to develop their agency and how to make it accomplish its purpose, would come to a meeting with people with many, many things to decide, in which a very few minutes would be given to making decisions that would completely overturn, perhaps without members even realizing, things they had been working on the whole year. And consequently, in self-defense, these organizations had to either be simply changing from year to year and never knowing whether they'd even last, or they had to develop a system whereby they could control what the denomination would do as regards them the next year. And the result is that denominations that have denominationally controlled agencies usually become agency-controlled denominations to a very large extent, inevitably. And the agencies, as they fell into the hands of modernists, the modernists naturally assumed more and more control of the denominations. And that is the process that has been used to take over so many of our denominations in recent years. And so the ecclesiastical situation in our denominations is very important in their procedure, but in a country that has a state church, it's even more important. And here under this, the ecclesiastical situation in Europe at the eve of the Reformation, we note under number one, the theory of a united church. The theory of a united church. This theory came from the old idea of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was supposedly extended over most of the civilized world, and the empire was under the general control of the emperor and his staff, and they tended to control religion as well as other matters. And the emperor had a title which came from old Roman days, Rome being along the edges of the Tiber on both sides of the river. An important thing was the building of bridges. So the emperor had taken the title Chief Bridge Builder, Pontifex Maximus, Chief Bridge Builder. And the emperor took this title, which formerly had been the title of the head of the Roman pagan religion. And then when the empire moved its headquarters to Constantinople, the bishop of Rome took over the religious title that the emperor had previously had and called himself the chief bridge builder. And so in Rome, if you see an inscription put up by a pope as recently as within the last century, you will see after his name the word Pontifex Maximus, chief bridge builder. Or just the letter PM very frequently, even though I don't suppose any pope for years has built any bridges. But it is a title coming from old Roman paganism, representing the headship of the religion of the empire. And so even though the Roman Empire had split into many divisions as barbarian tribes had taken over one section and another of it, the theory still remained that they were part of one big empire. And while this theory largely became purely theoretical in the political sphere, it maintained itself in the religious sphere. It was a theory that the church was one united church with one head who was in Rome. And so this theory of a united church, which was carried, was in some areas a very real thing, and in other areas purely a matter of form and name, was a very important thing in the thinking of just about everybody in the Middle Ages. There was one united church throughout the empire. And as to what the authority the Bishop of Rome had in it, theories differed. Some thought of him as an absolute monarch, others thought of him as merely an executive officer or a presiding officer at meetings. Ideas varied, but the theory of the United Church was universally, almost universally, accepted at that time. And number two, the monastery. This is something that is practically unknown to us in Protestantism, but during the Middle Ages, it was the means that kept Christianity alive in Europe. People seeking refuge from the violence, the war, the uncertainty of the Middle Ages would flee to the monastery. Some of them simply seeking a place of safety, but many of them seeking a chance to develop their religious life in peace and security. And these monasteries had periods when they were great centers of spiritual life, and other periods when they degenerated into a very worldly and often wicked groups of men. They, like all human institutions, had their ups and downs. But at the time of the beginning of the Reformation, they were one of the most conspicuous seekers in Europe, because all through the previous centuries, many people had left great legacies to these monasteries. And so the monasteries controlled a very large portion of the land of Europe, and a great deal of the wealth. They had many very great buildings. They had large numbers of people in them, in these monasteries and convents, for some for men, some for women. They were widespread all through Europe. Number three, the hierarchy. The hierarchy. The word hierarchy simply comes from the Greek hieros, a priest, and arch, a government or a ruler. It means a word hierarchy has come to mean simply a rising succession of leaders with individuals having a larger number under them, and is used in many ways today in that connection, not necessarily ecclesiastically. But part of the theory of the United Church, and also the parallels to the feudalism that was characteristic of the political life of the Middle Ages, in which each one was subject to someone else, and then he subject to someone else, and so on, theoretically, up to the emperor, was the organization whereby the priests all over Europe were subject to bishops over certain areas, and they to archbishops, and they to leaders of their nations, and they to the authorities in Rome. And so there was this hierarchical organization which theoretically had control and direction over all the churches. But in this hierarchy, in the latter part of the Middle Ages, there had developed a great deal of corruption. This had developed partly because during the Middle Ages, the clergy were the only people who had much education. And as a result, the civil officials were very anxious to have their assistance. And so the church officials came to have, many of them have important positions in the civil world, and many of them became simply striving after political advancement themselves, and the church position was quite incidental. It reminds me of the time when I'm in Los Angeles, shortly before I went to seminary, I spoke to the presiding officer of the presbytery there about my desires, and he took me with him to a dinner attended by the Presbyterian ministers from the whole area of Southern California. And at this dinner, they, most of them, were asked to introduce themselves. And I was shocked to hear the way they introduced themselves. Because a man would say, I am the secretary of the Rotary Club of Santa Barbara, and I preach on Sundays in the Second Presbyterian Church. And the next one would say, I am the leader in the Kiwanis Club in such and such a place, and I preach on Sundays in such a church. It seems to me as if they were trying to take positions in social and political life, and the church was quite incidental, rather than being the means of winning people to salvation through Christ through all eternity, which is so much more important than anything that you can have in connection with this life. But it's a tendency that creeps into all of us if we don't watch out, to see the temporary local things as being of tremendous importance and to overlook the far more important eternal things. But this being the case, and also it being the situation that the political rulers and leaders would, for good control, it was desirable usually not to divide up their territory among their children. If they did, soon it would decrease in a few generations to practically nothing. To leave it to the oldest son, but they want to do something for the other son. And the best thing to do for them was to get them a good position in the church. And so the second son of the rulers, and I don't mean merely the kings, I mean the dukes and the counts and people like that, they usually tried to get them a good position in the church. It might be an abbot of a monastery or a bishop of an area and so on. And so the hierarchy came to be very heavily infiltrated with worldly corruption. And as a result of this, there were three particular types of corruption that came in that became very common. One of these was pluralism. Pluralism. A man might hold several church positions when any one of them would be enough to take a full-time activity of man. And the result was that they became merely names. And some hireling did the work of them to whatever extent the work was really done. While this man of noble blood perhaps drew the income from it but didn't do any of the work. Reminds me of some years ago in the Oriental Club of Philadelphia, I used to hear lectures by different members of the club who were leading in various phases of study. And one of them was a man who had been in China and who had been quite active in Chinese studies and had given some lectures in the university about China. And I happened to meet him on the street one day and asked him how he was getting along. Oh, he says, we got a new bishop. And he says, the new bishop noticed that I had six cinch jobs, each of which was paying me a good income and no one of which I had to do any work for. And he said, the bishop said, well, if you're getting paid for all these cinch jobs, we might as well give you a real job you won't get paid for. So he said, he's given me another job I have to do that takes 9/10 of my time I don't get any pay for. Well, it was interesting to strike there in that that was connected, happened to be the Episcopal Church this man belonged to, but that was a similar situation to what developed so much in the Middle Ages. That there were all kinds of positions that had an income or a salary connected with them, and a man could hold the position and take the income and then leave the work undone or else hire somebody else to fill in to some extent. And so by the time of the Reformation, this had so developed that in England, I have a list downstairs in a book on England on the eve of the Reformation, which lists about 10 selected church officials in England, each of whom had about 10 different positions, sometimes several hundred miles apart, and none of which they did any work. It had become very, very common, and this thing of pluralism, it's one of the many corruptions that came in. Now, of course, the Roman Catholic view today is that at the time of the Reformation, the church was very corrupt. There was worldliness, there was corruption in it. It needed to be corrected. I have a Roman Catholic history which has described this chapter on this period as Protestant revolt and Roman Catholic reform, the way they describe it. That is, all scholars recognize that there was great need of reform, of reforming these corruptions and abuses. But that is not the vital thing about the Reformation. Corruptions and abuses creep in every organization and need to be reformed from time to time. But the vital thing of the Reformation is not the reforming of abuses, it is the replacing of worldly teaching by the presentation of the gospel. That is the Bible. And we call the Reformation, therefore, the Reformation, and we refer to the Roman Catholic reform of abuses that eventually came as the Counter-Reformation. But the two are quite different. But the Reformation had much easier progress than it would have had if it had been only a spiritual movement. That is to say, it was greatly strengthened by the fact that so many people saw these abuses and corruptions in the church, which all intelligent people had seen for two or three centuries then, and attempt after attempt had been made to reform, and no progress had been made. And they had become so worse, so bad, that all intelligent people realized something needed to be done about it. But the wonderful thing is that in God's providence, what was done was not simply to reform abuses, but was to bring real reformation, which revived the preaching of the gospel and spread it throughout Europe, as we shall see as we go on. But along with pluralism, there is a second abuse, which is a second type of corruption, which is so closely connected with pluralism, it's almost the same thing, and yet it could exist apart from it. That was absenteeism. Absenteeism. There were young Englishmen of noble blood who had been made bishop of a certain great district of England when they were 12 years old. And they received the income from that all their lives, though they never went near the place. Absenteeism. The leader of the Church of England was also given by the King of Spain the position of head of one of the big monasteries in Spain. And so he received this income from Spain, though he probably never visited at all. This absenteeism is not entirely done away with now, though it was pretty well reformed by the reforms that came in connection both with the Reformation and with the Counter-Reformation. A sort of an illustration of it is found today in the situation of the cardinals. Most people today do not realize, we mentioned it last year in church history, that the position of cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church is not a position like bishop or archbishop. It is not a member of the hierarchy. A cardinal, theoretically, is a member of the Roman clergy. And theoretically, the Pope is the bishop of Rome, that is, he is the head of the Roman clergy. And it is only because Rome was thought of as the head of the whole world that he is thought of as head of the church throughout the world. And so the a cardinal is simply a member of the Roman Catholic clergy. I mean, of the Roman clergy of the city of Rome. And every cardinal, in his statement making him cardinal, it declares that he is the priest of this little church in Rome, or he's the bishop of this section of Rome, or he's a deacon in such a church in Rome. And so theoretically, the cardinals who gather on the death of a pope to elect a new pope are simply the local clergy of Rome gathering for that purpose. And yet hardly one of them has anything to do with the work of the local clergy of Rome. Other men do that work who do not have a vote in the election of the bishop of Rome as cardinals, as members of the Roman clergy. And you will read that the Archbishop of New York is perhaps the deacon of a small church somewhere in Rome. That's what makes him a cardinal. And he's maybe never been there, but now that we have planes and you can get back and forth so quickly, perhaps once in his life he'll go to that little church and hold a service there. The church of which, theoretically, ever since he became cardinal, he was the deacon or priest or whatever position he held in that church. And so that is a form of absenteeism. It's purely a legal fiction now. But it was a very vital thing at the beginning of the Reformation because such great numbers of men were absentee officials in the church. In fact, the beginning of the Reformation came when the younger son of one of the German dukes had been made the bishop of one section of Germany, and then he had been made the archbishop of another large section of Germany. And then his father having died and his older brother, who was the duke, wanting to do something for his younger brother, he went to Rome and asked the pope to make his brother the archbishop of still another large section of Germany, which would make him actually archbishop of about two-thirds of Germany. And the pope agreed to do it for a large consideration, which had to be raised by selling indulgences. And it was from the selling of those that the Reformation actually began. We'll look at that a little later, of course. But along with these, there came a third abuse, which had become widespread through the Middle Ages, which has been come to go by the name of simony. Simony. And this is named after Simon Magus in the book of Acts, who came to the apostles and offered them money and said, give me the power to put my hands on people and the Holy Spirit will come on them. And he offered money thus for an ecclesiastical power. And so that name came early in the Middle Ages to be given to the purchase of church offices. And it was very common in the Middle Ages that anyone who had the appointment to a church office would receive a large sum of money in return for appointing somebody. And often there was just, he would give it to the highest bidder. It was everyone considered it as wrong, but it was widely practiced and was one of the great abuses at this time. Now, along with these, one might mention a lesser abuse and yet a real one, which they called nepotism. And nepotism, the word nepotism, comes from the Latin nepos, which means a nephew. Theoretically, the popes never had children. Some of them did, of course. Many of them did. But theoretically, they did not. And consequently, if they were to do something for their relatives, the natural one to do it for was a nephew. And so nepotism means appointing somebody to a position because he's a relative of yours. And this was very common among the popes and leaders in high positions in the church. And there's no reason why a relative might not be the most able man, the one best fitted for the position. But in the majority of cases, they were not. And so, actually, whether a person is a relative or not should not be a deciding factor. But when it was called nepotism, and this was very widespread. This leads naturally to number four, the Pope. The Pope. Last semester, we noticed how there was a division in the 14th century in which there were two men, each claiming to be Pope, and each having about half the nations of Europe recognizing him as Pope. And how eventually, early in the 15th century, a century before the Reformation, the Council of Constance was held, at which representatives came from every nation of Europe, determined to put an end to this business of having two men claiming to be head of the church. And there were three by that time. But they put an end to it. They did away with all three of them. And in their place, they selected a new one, and they commissioned him to reform the church, do away with all these abuses, and to have a new council every 10 years. And they thought of the Pope as simply an executive officer, and the council that would meet once every 10 years would run the church. That was their theory at the Council of Constance from 1414 to 1418. But they would come from all over Europe. They had their local affairs to consider. The Pope was permanently in the position, and he had all his time to give to thinking of it. And so the result was that the Pope managed to outwit them. And the next two or three times he called a council and then found some reason to prevent the council from doing anything. And eventually they quit calling them all together. So that the idea of a council controlling the church was pushed out of the way. And the new group of popes that came after that devoted themselves to beautifying the city of Rome and to living lives of luxury and ease and paid comparatively little attention to religious affairs in the church. And this rapidly became worse, so that by the time of the Reformation, 100 years after the Council of Constance, the papacy had increased greatly in strength, in power, in wealth, in influence in European politics, but had largely become a secular organization, claiming to be the religious leader, but taking little interest in religion. And so the popes, by this time, were powerful, wealthy rulers, having secular rule over a large part of Italy, and claiming religious rule over all of Europe, and interested in their own pleasures and in the advancement of the members of their family, and little interested in religion. And so the popes, when the Reformation began, were rather tolerant individuals. That is, so long as you didn't interfere with their power or prestige or wealth. Well, you could think most anything you wanted, and the popes weren't apt to interfere with you at the beginning of the Reformation. So long as they received their cut from just about everything, so long as they had their life of luxury, had their recognition, their standing, and their honor given to them, they didn't pay much attention. And that's one thing that in the providence of God made it possible for the Reformation to get well underway. If the Pope, at the beginning of the Reformation, had exercised the power that theoretically was there, and that had been exercised by certain popes centuries before and by some in later years, they could have wiped out the Reformation before it got started and put a complete end to it. But the popes at the beginning of the Reformation were just not much interested in religion. And the Reformation got a 20-year start before they had popes who realized how important it was and were determined to wipe it out. And when they did, they succeeded in wiping it out to half of Europe. In the northern two-thirds of Europe was almost completely taken over by the Reformation, and the southern third of Europe had considerable Reformation teaching in it before the Pope set themselves to this task. When they did, they completely wiped it out from the southern third and from nearly half of the territory that the Reformation had taken over. And so Austria, for instance, 50 years after the beginning of the Reformation, Austria was almost solidly Protestant. But 50 years or 100 years after that, it had been so completely taken over by the Pope that no Protestant book could be distributed or even looked at by anyone in Austria. It became solidly Roman Catholic and is practically that way to this day. The Counter-Reformation, but won back a great part of the territory that the Reformation took over, but it could have wiped out the Reformation completely at the beginning, but the popes were very tolerant so long as you didn't interfere with their prerogatives, their power, and their money at the beginning of the Reformation. They were corrupt on the whole, corrupt worldly rulers going to religious forms. And of course, this was not realized in the greater part of Europe. Luther, when the Reformation began, thought the Pope was a great spiritual leader. And he thought that the Pope had no idea what his supposed representatives were doing in Germany, and that once the true facts were pointed out to him, the Pope would immediately side with Luther. That's what Luther expected. And Luther, when they brought him a decision against him by the Pope, he appealed from the Pope ill-informed to the Pope better-informed. And one of his greatest works has an introduction to the Pope in which he says to the Pope, he says, you are, he had come to decide the leaders in Rome were all wicked, but he didn't think the Pope was. So he said, you are a lamb in the midst of the wolves, he said. And he went ahead and thought that the poor Pope just was being kept from getting the true information. People throughout Europe didn't realize the situation. But the situation was that the Pope had become merely worldly leaders. We will look a little at more detail at this later, of course. Now we look at D, the political situation at the beginning of the Reformation. Capital D, and the political situation at the beginning of the Reformation, we will not look at in much detail now. We will glance at certain of its details as we go along, naturally, in the history. Some of its details are very important for understanding the Reformation, and so we will want to have them in mind. The main thing to mention right now is the division between the theoretical situation and the actual situation in European politics. The theoretical situation was that the Roman Empire still existed. That was the theoretical situation. Theoretically, all of Europe was one empire. So the Roman Empire in Europe had been dead for 1,000 years. Theoretically, there was one empire and there was one emperor. And this emperor theoretically had control over all of Europe, though as a matter of actual practice in in England and in France, he had no actual power whatever. And in certain other areas of Europe, he had a small amount of power. And then there were areas in which he was constantly trying to establish himself as quite powerful. The principal areas where he was trying to establish himself as quite powerful were Germany and Italy. Theoretically, the Roman Emperor was a ruler of all Europe, but particularly of Germany and of Italy. And he had been, for some centuries, always a German. And this German king, who was elected by other German rulers as emperor, theoretically was emperor of the whole Roman Empire. But he actually usually did not receive the title of emperor until he was crowned by the Pope. And so it was important he go to Rome and get the Pope to crown him. The Pope had no power in the selection of him, whatever. But the Pope, it was desired the Pope should crown him. They were apt to call him King of Rome or some such title till he was crowned, and then to call him Roman Emperor. Although in time they came to call him Roman Emperor right from the time when he had been elected, although theoretically he wasn't, till he was crowned by the Pope. And so this, for a period of some centuries, the German emperors, who were theoretically Roman emperors, devoted a great part of their time and energy to trying to control Germany and Italy both. And the result was they controlled neither one. Theoretically, they were in control over both, and they had a certain amount of power, but much of it was nominal. Actually, Germany was divided, and so was Italy, into many different sections. About a third of Italy was under the direct rule of the Pope, called the Papal State. Then the Sicily was usually under control of the King of Spain. And the northern half of Italy was divided into little principalities, theoretically subject to the emperor, but actually all of them quite independent. The city of Venice was independent all through the Middle Ages up to the time of Napoleon. It never granted any actual subservience to any other part. Venice was an independent state. And these other parts of northern Italy sometimes would admit a certain alleged subservience, but in actual fact, they were quite independent, as though theoretically under the emperor. The same was true of Germany. Germany was divided into kingdoms and duchies and domains of various counts and quite a number of imperial free cities, which controlled themselves, were subject to no earthly ruler except for a nominal subjection to the emperor. And so there was this great variety of political control in Germany and Italy. And if a man was elected emperor who was duke of or count of some little area, or someone who just had his little castle, didn't have much power, as an emperor, he was purely nominal, and nobody paid much attention to him except for formal occasions. So naturally, they tended to elect a man as emperor who had some power himself, who was duke of one of the big sections of Germany. And if they elected a man who was duke of a large section of Germany or a king of a certain area, he would have enough power in his own domain to perhaps enforce a certain authority over other sections. And so it came to be quite frequently a man who had considerable power himself who would be elected the emperor. In 1520, when they had to elect a new emperor, the King of England tried very hard to get elected emperor. He was anxious to be elected the emperor. Although, and theoretically, England was part of it, though actually the empire had no control whatever over England. At the beginning of the Reformation, the emperor was a man who was about as typical a German as there's ever been in history, a man named Maximilian, a bluff, tragic sort of a man, friendly with everybody, well-liked by all his people, considered by the Germans as a true German in every way. And Maximilian was, as they say, a pleasant sort of a fellow, not an extremely able fellow, but he was the ruler of Austria. Austria today is a separate country, but the word actually means Eastern realm, and Austria simply was considered an eastern, rather southeastern part of Germany. It was a part of Germany all through the Middle Ages, and very often towards the time of the Reformation, the Duke of Austria was the man who was elected emperor, and Maximilian was the Duke of Austria. And he set to work to increase his power by marriage. And so he married the daughter of the Duke of Burgundy. Now, Burgundy included the Netherlands, Belgium, and the northern part of France. So it was quite a sizable region and a very successful commercial region was Burgundy. And Charles the Bold, the Duke of Burgundy, when he died, left only a daughter, Mary, and Maximilian, Mary, married the daughter of the Duke of Burgundy. And so he who was Duke of Austria became also Duke of Burgundy. And this meant that he was in control of Austria. And then you had Switzerland and Italy and France in between you and his other new realm, which was north of France, the region of Burgundy, today Holland and Belgium and the northern part of France. Yeah, theoretically, his wife Mary was the ruler of this, but she died before long, and her son was nominally, the little baby was nominally ruler, Maximilian was the one who had the honor, and the Burgundy was rather independent. So Maximilian, his children lived largely in Burgundy instead of in Austria. And then Maximilian's son, who died fairly young, died before Maximilian did, but as he grew up and was nominally Duke of Burgundy, he marries a daughter of the King of Spain, probably the only King of Spain that all Americans know the name of, King Ferdinand, the husband of Isabella. So Ferdinand and Isabella had a daughter that had no sons, so their oldest daughter was in line to succeed them, and she married Maximilian's son. And so he would be in line to be King of Spain. And so his son would be in line to be Duke of Austria, way down in the southeast, to be Duke of Burgundy, way up in the northwest, and to be King of Spain, way down in the southwest, with other hostile territories in between. And Maximilian said, "Oh, if my grandson can only be elected emperor, think of all the territory he will control." And so this was the question that was open just at the time the Reformation began. Could he succeed in becoming emperor and having all his territory under his nominal control? And young Charles, when he was 20 years of age, was elected emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And Charles V, emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, is one of the most prominent characters in the whole history of the Reformation. He was probably everything I've said about him thus far we will repeat once or twice in the course, because he is rather important in our history. And he spent an active life, and he was on the whole a pretty good character of man, a fairly good type of character. I described his death to him yesterday. But he was a fairly good type of man, but a man who set to work to try to gained real control over this territory of which he was in nominal control, and he spent his whole life working at it and failed. But it is very important in the political history of the time of the Reformation. And incidentally, as you all know, his father and mother had given Columbus some ships to sail westward. And so the result was that he not only controlled all this part of Europe, but the southern part of North America and all of the western part of South America. And during his life, he had great ships bringing him gold and precious things from America, the money from which he spent in trying to maintain his control over Europe. So in the end, it did him very little good. But hardly anyone in history has nominally ruled such a large area as Charles V did. And he is very important in the political history of the time of the Reformation. Yes?
Charles V was his son,
grandson. See, his father died before the grandfather, so that Charles is the grandson of Maximilian. But through all these marriages, he became the leader of all this area. Now, Maximilian belonged to an old family called the Habsburgs, and the name is still sometimes referred to even today, because they became very important in European politics. Now, this is incidental to our interest in the religious development. But Charles V's activity and power had a great deal to do with how the Reformation proceeded. And so it will be necessary we be quite familiar with him before long. At this point, I'm not really so much introducing him as giving you a general idea of the political situation at the time when the Reformation began. Now, capital E, the intellectual situation. The intellectual situation, the political situation is very important, as is the ecclesiastical, in relation to the question, will the Reformation be wiped out by force before it can get underway? It's very important from that viewpoint. But the intellectual situation is very important, far more important in a way, because it relates to how the Reformation came to come just at this time, and how did it come to become widely extended at this period. It is very important. All we can do in this class is to glance at a few of its outstanding features. But number one is the Renaissance. R-E-N-A-I-S-S-A-N-C-E, the Renaissance. That is a term which has come to be applied to the intellectual situation in the century before the Reformation, and still continuing to some extent into the 16th century. The word Renaissance means new birth, and truly it seemed like a new birth, because for 1,000 years Europe had been in the Dark Ages, gradually establishing civilization out of the turmoil, disruption, and confusion that had come from the downfall of the Roman Empire for 1,000 years. But now there came what seemed like a new birth, in that there were many people who didn't have to be struggling 15, 16 hours a day to get enough to eat, or worrying 9/10 of the time for fear that marauders would come in and take everything they had, but who were able to give time and effort to developing various phases of their life and of their study. And there was a great outpouring of talent during this period. It showed itself in many lines. One was in art. And to me, there's nothing in the field of art that thrills me half as much as the art of the Renaissance. Most of it is in Italy. In Italy, the high Renaissance, you find the art of the very time of Martin Luther, which represents a century of gradual discovery of principles in art, which principles came to be applied and combined in a most wonderful way. And I don't think in art there's been anything since that compares, in my opinion, with the art of the Renaissance. But most of it is in Italy. Most of it is too precious to ever be allowed to leave that country, except for a very brief time. They brought Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa over to this country two or three years ago, for a period in Washington, D.C., and they said people were lined up 1,000 in line waiting to get a minute to look at the Mona Lisa. Well, we had been in Paris the year before, and there in the Louvre we saw the Mona Lisa, and very few people were even stopping to look at it, because there were 3 or 4 other Renaissance pictures within a stone's throw of it that we liked much better than we did the Mona Lisa. But it is typical of the high art of the Renaissance. It reached a very, very high peak at this time. And the Reformation comes when the Renaissance is reaching its peak. Thus, it has behind us a century of development of art, of architecture, advances in science, development of the ability to develop in various lines of human thought and activity. And one thing that contributed much to this was the disunion of Italy. Because in Italy, you had many petty princes in northern Italy and central Italy who had a little capital, and they would have visitors from other areas, and they wanted to show them that they had better art, more beautiful churches, and finer palaces than they did. And so the local people would all be given a chance to try to draw something or try to do some sculpture, and ones who had ability, who in our age might go through their whole life and never learn to do anything in art, except a little sketching for their children, maybe, there would their ability be recognized, and they would be given a chance to develop. And the result was that there was development of the artistic ability of these people in Italy then, surpassing what's been found in the world ever before since. I don't think the people were so much more able than in other areas at other times, but that there was an opportunity, a situation that stimulated them and gave them opportunity. But you find this development in all fields of life, and it stimulated people to think for themselves and to make progress. And we find it in architecture, the great architecture of the Renaissance. They invented gunpowder at this time, which made much of the fighting of the Middle Ages rather irrelevant. The people who had access to the gunpowder had the greater power. Fortunately, no one group got it immediately. It was rather widespread soon, but it did cut down the violence a good bit. And then it was a period of great exploration. You know, as we noticed, it was just before this that Columbus had discovered America, and shortly before that, the Portuguese had rounded Africa and gone on to India, and it was shortly after that Magellan went completely round the world, and so you had a great period of exploration. And with just a few years before the beginning of the Reformation, printing had been invented. People were more interested in writing and literature than they had been before. Now, someone suggested the idea, we don't know who it was really, who suggested the idea of taking little blocks with letters on, and instead of writing every page out separately, of taking these little blocks and stamping them. And so a very crude sort of printing had begun 50 or more years before the Reformation. It was just beginning to become a real industry just about when the Reformation began. And in the providence of God, it was a most marvelous preparation for the Renaissance, before the Reformation. Luther's work were printed in more copies than perhaps all other works put together for a number of years. And the amount of printing doubled and tripled in the first few years of Luther's activity, largely because of people's desire to get copies of Luther's work. So printing was a tremendous help in getting the Reformation established. We'll continue there next Tuesday, and please be here on time. Let's not anybody come in late next Tuesday and disturb the rest of the class.